Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for In the News and American Stories, coming up after As It Is. Hello again, and welcome to As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans in Washington. Today on the program, we have two stories about countries on the continent of Asia. Thailand is the third largest exporter of fish and fishery products in the world. Those exports are worth more than $8 billion. But the Thai fishing industry is under attack because of reports of labor rights abuses and human trafficking. Many of the workers come from Cambodia and Myanmar, also known as Burma. The United Nations International Labor Organization reports that up to 20% of workers on Thai fishing boats have faced forced labor. Rights groups have reported widespread abuses on Thai boats. The groups say the country's fishing industry remains poorly governed and legislated. The American-based Human Rights Watch produced a report on the Thai seafood industry. The report says labor shortages have led the seafood industry to turn largely to foreign workers. It says recruitment dealers have targeted men from Cambodia, Myanmar, and even Thailand. Phil Robertson is Deputy Asia Director of Human Rights Watch. He says some men were forced to work in the fishing industry. He says they reported threats of violence and abuse on fishing boats.
We continually see problems of physical abuse by captains and other officers. Every group of fishermen that Human Rights Watch has talked to said they had seen captains beating, abusing, in some cases killing fishermen. If a fisherman falls asleep, is sick, is injured, they're compelled to keep going. They can't stop work. We found beatings with tools, with stingray tails, also shootings.
Fishermen face long working hours. Some work up to 20 hours a day. There is little time to rest or eat. Only when fishing nets are down in the water and after the fish are caught and sorted can the workers rest. A Thai Labor Department proposal to employ prisoners on boats to make up for labor shortfalls was rejected after an international outcry. Patima Tungpashunyakung is with the Seafarers Action Center and Labor Rights Promotion Network Foundation. She says some of those trafficked say they were drugged before being put on boats. She says many received little or no pay. She also says the conditions on boats often make people want to leave.
บางคนบอกว่าผมมาขอกลับบ้านทํา 2-3 ปีแล้วเอกสารถูกยึดและโดนทิ้ง
She says people have appealed to return home after being at sea up to 3 years. Identification documents and passports are often withheld or thrown into the sea. Many workers fear death if they stay on the boat. So they instead jump ship to survive. She says many bodies of fishermen have been uncovered in Indonesia. At least 9 Thais were confirmed dead. 30 workers from Myanmar were also found. Wanshai Pinjabat traveled to Indonesia. He says the need for labor is so great that recruiters turn to children and older adults to fill job vacancies on boats.
บุคคลที่ถูกหลอกมานั้นจะเป็นกลุ่มที่เรียกว่าคนหัวเรือคือหมายถึงคนหัวเรือ
He says those tricked into working on the boats work like slaves or worse than slaves. There are long hours of work and for many the conditions are what he calls unendurable. Phil Robertson says Thailand's international image in the seafood industry is at stake.
Overseas, the reputation of Thai seafood has now been really brought into disrepute. There are many different companies who are sourcing from Thailand who are now looking at how do we ensure that the fish products that we're buying here or the shrimp that is being raised on fish meal is not tainted with forced labor and trafficked persons' sweat and tears.
Last year, the United States lowered Thailand's rating in its Trafficking in Persons report. U.S. officials placed Thailand in Tier 3, the lowest rating possible. The move leaves Thailand open to financial and other non-humanitarian measures. The Thai government has reacted with a campaign to end human trafficking and abuses. Steps include a tightening of rules in the fishing industry and increasing the lowest legal age for workers to 18 years. The government will also register all boats and require vessel monitoring systems on all boats by February. Rights workers say they welcome the legislation and the steps to fight trafficking. But they add the laws will need to be enforced to be really effective. You are listening to As It Is from VOA Learning English. Chinese officials say North Koreans are crossing the border and committing crimes in China. To protect the area, China is organizing civilian patrols in the Yambian border region. It is unclear if these civilian patrols have guns. Private citizens in China are not permitted to own guns, but officials make some exceptions for people who have permits for hunting. Matthew Halsall is with Duryana, a Christian organization that helps defectors escape from North Korea. He says North Korean soldiers are committing most of the crimes near the border. For instance, a North Korean soldier reportedly killed 4 people in the area during a robbery attempt in December. Mr. Halsall also says the crimes near the border are increasing fears Chinese have of North Korean defectors.
What's a massive problem is the Chinese public's perception of North Korean defectors. You know, and the fact is that the Chinese do just see North Korean defectors as, you know, economic migrants and have very low opinions of them.
The number of defectors crossing into China has decreased significantly in the last few years, in spite of poverty and malnutrition in North Korea. Part of the reason is because North Korea has increased the number of border guards. The government has also started using harsher punishments for Koreans caught trying to cross the border. But China is still concerned about border safety and security. In addition to the civilian guards, China has installed video cameras and a telephone hotline to report illegal activity. Kong Dong-won is a professor of international relations at Dong-a University in Busan, South Korea. He says the increase in crime and security measures at the border does not suggest any change in the relationship between China and North Korea. The countries are close allies and trading partners. Professor Kong says the authorization of the civilian militias is just a measure to protect Chinese citizens living in the border regions. And that's our program for today. Be sure to join us again tomorrow for another As It Is. I'm Jonathan Evans. Thanks for listening.
In the News is next, followed by American Stories. You can read and listen to our programs and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
From VOA Learning English, this is In the News. This week, the rights group Freedom House reported a general decline in political and civil rights around the world last year. The group said its measure of international freedom has dropped in each of the past 9 years. It added that democratic ideals are now under the greatest threat in 25 years. A Freedom House report described 2014 as, in its words, an exceptionally grim year. It noted an explosion of terrorist violence and aggressive methods worldwide. Nowhere was the loss of freedom more apparent, it said, than in the Middle East. The Islamic State militant group killed large numbers of people as it captured parts of Iraq and Syria. Freedom House says ineffective and oppressive leadership in those countries helped open the door to the militants. Syria received Freedom House's lowest country rating in over 10 years. Syria has faced civil war and terrorist violence. The new report said Tunisia was the one exception to the unrest. It recognized Tunisia as the first Arab country to become free in the past 40 years. Arch Puddington is vice president for research at Freedom House. He wrote the new report. He says the most severe losses in freedom were a result of terrorism.
One of the most discouraging developments is this upsurge in terrorism. We have never seen in the past, ever, seen the impact of terrorism on democracy to be as significant as it was in 2014.
Arch Puddington says terrorist attacks have led to thousands of people being displaced. He adds that women were kidnapped or seized as prizes of war. He also noted the killing of religious minorities in Africa, the Middle East, and South Asia. Freedom House says a lack of democratic freedoms created the environment for terrorism to grow. The group says about 2.6 billion people live under what it calls not free conditions. That represents about a third of the world's population. The report notes Russia's involvement in the violence in eastern Ukraine and its takeover of the Crimean Peninsula. It criticizes Russian attacks on media as examples of the government's disrespect for democratic standards. The report notes the Egyptian government's pushback on democratic gains and its suppression of the media, human rights groups, and political dissidents. Freedom House says the government in Turkey launched an aggressive campaign against its opponents, as did the government in China. Thomas Hughes is executive director of Article 19, a British human rights group. He says changes in the United States and its Western allies hurt democratic ideals.
The other really worrying trend has been that in countries in Europe and North America where we've seen the traditional strong defenders of human rights internationally, because of their encroachment around issues such as mass surveillance, encroachment around human rights-related issues, this sets a very negative precedent.
Freedom House says the biggest mistake democracies can make is to accept the idea that they are helpless when facing strongmen who use force or threaten others. It notes that everyday citizens have shown their willingness to challenge such rulers. And that's In the News from VOA Learning English. I'm Christopher Cruz.
Now, the special English program, American Stories. Today we complete the story Rappaccini's Daughter. It was written by Nathaniel Hawthorne. Here is Kay Gallant with the second and final part of Rappaccini's Daughter.
Many years ago, a young man named Giovanni Guasconti left his home in Naples to study in northern Italy. He took a room in an old house next to a magnificent garden filled with strange flowers and other plants. The garden belonged to a doctor, Giacomo Rappaccini. He lived with his daughter Beatrice in a small brown house in the garden. From a window in his room, Giovanni had seen that Rappaccini's daughter was very beautiful. But everyone in Padua was afraid of her father. Pietro Baglioni, a professor at the university, warned Giovanni about the mysterious Dr. Rappaccini. "He is a great scientist," Professor Baglioni told the young man. "But he is also dangerous. Rappaccini cares more about science than he does about people. He has created many terrible poisons from the plants in his garden." One day, Giovanni found a secret entrance to Rappaccini's garden. He went in. The plants all seemed wild and unnatural. Giovanni realized that Rappaccini must have created these strange and terrible flowers through his experiments. Suddenly, Rappaccini's daughter came into the garden. She moved quickly among the flowers until she reached him. Giovanni apologized for coming into the garden without an invitation, but Beatrice smiled at him and made him feel welcome. "I see you love flowers," she said, "and so you have come to take a closer look at my father's rare collection." While she spoke, Giovanni noticed a perfume in the air around her. He wasn't sure if this wonderful smell came from the flowers or from her breath. She asked him about his home and his family. She told him she had spent her life in this garden. Giovanni felt as if he were talking to a very small child. Her spirit sparkled like clear water. They walked slowly through the garden as they talked. At last, they reached a beautiful plant that was covered with large purple flowers. He realized that the perfume from those flowers was like the perfume of Beatrice's breath, but much stronger. The young man reached out to break off one of the purple flowers, but Beatrice gave a scream that went through his heart like a knife. She caught his hand and pulled it away from the plant with all her strength. "Don't ever touch those flowers," she cried. "They will take your life." Hiding her face, she ran into the house. Then Giovanni saw Dr. Rappaccini standing in the garden. That night, Giovanni could not stop thinking about how sweet and beautiful Beatrice was. Finally, he fell asleep. But when the morning came, he woke up in great pain. He felt as if one of his hands was on fire. It was the hand that Beatrice had grabbed in hers when he had reached for one of the purple flowers. Giovanni looked down at his hand. There was a purple mark on it that looked like four small fingers and a little thumb. But because his heart was full of Beatrice, Giovanni forgot about the pain in his hand. He began to meet her in the garden every day. At last, she told him that she loved him, but she would never let him kiss her or even hold her hand. One morning, several weeks later, Professor Baglioni visited Giovanni. "I was worried about you," the older man said. "You have not come to your classes at the university for more than a month. Is something wrong?" Giovanni was not pleased to see his old friend. "No, nothing is wrong. I am fine, thank you." He wanted Professor Baglioni to leave, but the old man took off his hat and sat down. "My dear Giovanni," he said, "you must stay away from Rappaccini and his daughter. Her father has given her poison from the time she was a baby. The poison is in her blood and on her breath. If Rappaccini did this to his own daughter, what is he planning to do to you?" Giovanni covered his face with his hands. "Oh, my God," he cried. "Don't worry," the old man continued. "It is not too late to save you, and we may succeed in helping Beatrice, too. Do you see this little silver bottle? It holds a medicine that will destroy even the most powerful poison. Give it to your Beatrice to drink." Professor Baglioni put the little bottle on the table and left Giovanni's room. The young man wanted to believe that Beatrice was a sweet and innocent girl, and yet Professor Baglioni's words had put doubts in his heart. It was nearly time for his daily meeting with Beatrice. As Giovanni combed his hair, he looked at himself in a mirror near his bed. He could not help noticing how handsome he was. His eyes looked particularly bright, and his face had a healthy, warm glow. He said to himself, "At least her poison has not gotten into my body yet." As he spoke, he happened to look at some flowers he had just bought that morning. A shock of horror went through his body. The flowers were turning brown. Giovanni's face became very white as he stared at himself in the mirror. Then he noticed a spider crawling near his window. He bent over the insect and blew a breath of air at it. The spider trembled and fell dead. "I am cursed," Giovanni whispered to himself. "My own breath is poison." At that moment, a rich, sweet voice came floating up from the garden. "Giovanni, you are late. Come down." "You are a monster," Giovanni shouted as soon as he reached her. "And with your poison you have made me into a monster too. I am a prisoner of this garden." "Giovanni," Beatrice cried, looking at him with her large bright eyes, "why are you saying these terrible things? It is true that I can never leave this garden, but you are free to go wherever you wish." Giovanni looked at her with hate in his eyes. Don't pretend that you don't know what you've done to me. A group of insects had flown into the garden. They came toward Giovanni and flew around his head. He blew his breath at them. The insects fell to the ground dead. Beatrice screamed, I see it! I see it! My father's science has done this to us. Believe me, Giovanni, I did not ask him to do this to you. I only wanted to love you. Giovanni's anger changed to sadness. Then he remembered the medicine that Professor Baglioni had given him. Perhaps the medicine would destroy the poison in their bodies and help them to become normal again. Dear Beatrice, he said, our fate is not so terrible. He showed her the little silver bottle and told her what the medicine inside it might do. I will drink first, she said. You must wait to see what happens to me before you drink it. She put Baglioni's medicine to her lips and took a small sip. At the same moment, Rappaccini came out of his house and walked slowly toward the two young people. He spread his hands out to them as if he were giving them a blessing. My daughter, he said, you are no longer alone in the world. Give Giovanni one of the purple flowers from your favorite plant. It will not hurt him now. My science and your love have made him different from ordinary men. My father, Beatrice said weakly, why did you do this terrible thing to your own child? Rappaccini looked surprised. What do you mean, my daughter? He asked. You have power no other woman has. You can defeat your strongest enemy with only a breath. Would you rather be a weak woman? I want to be loved, not feared, Beatrice replied. But now it does not matter. I am leaving you, father. I am going where the poison you have given me will do no harm. Goodbye to you, Giovanni. Beatrice dropped to the ground. She died at the feet of her father and Giovanni. The poison had been too much a part of the young woman. The medicine that destroyed the poison destroyed her as well.
You have just heard the story, Rappaccini's Daughter. It was written by Nathaniel Hawthorne and adapted for Special English by Donna DeSanctis. Your storyteller was Kay Galland. This is Shep O'Neill.